Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the hottest internet radio show and podcast, The Author's Lab, a place for an eclectic and lively discussion of the dynamic and volatile world of writing, publishing, and marketing of the written word. I'm your host, Robert Batista. Today's guest is the multi-talented author, songwriter, actress, and so much more, Lorraine Devon Wilkie. Lorraine, welcome to the Author's Lab.
Well, I'm very happy to be here, Robert. Really nice to talk to you again.
Oh, Lorraine, it's so great reconnecting with you again. And I know you recently went on a publicity tour for your latest stunning novel, The Alchemy of Noise. How did that experience work out for you?
It was really incredible. It was 6 weeks. It was over a six-week period. I had six different events, from Seattle to Chicago to San Diego to San Francisco to here in L.A., a couple of private events. And it was really great, after spending years working in solitude, which every writer does, to suddenly be among the people and have people in a bookstore or in a home listening to discussions about the book and asking questions. And luckily for me, several of them had read it beforehand. So people came with lots of very insightful questions. And it was very exciting to not only talk about, you know, the writer's process and what my experience is as an author, but also they wanted to talk about the themes within the book, which was, for me, really gratifying, because it's a book with some pretty significant, important, heavy themes, and I was really excited to see that people wanted to talk about those too, not just things like, where did you get your ideas, or what's your writer's process. I really appreciated that.
Right.
They wanted to talk about the narrative. So it was very exciting after, like I said, years of solitude with a computer. So it was exciting.
Yeah, it's good to get out and press the flesh, as they say. So you went to Chicago, where your latest book is set. Do you have any history of living in Chicago or that?
Yeah, I was born in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And
spent
the first few years of my life there. Then my family moved north to a tiny little farm town. But when I got older, my first two jobs were in downtown Chicago. I took a train in every day and walked to the Loop and worked at the insurance company where my dad worked. And it was a place where my band played, where I went for dates with my high school boyfriends, where I spent a lot of time during and after college, and I still have a lot of family and friends there, so I go there often. And so it's a city that I have a very special relationship with and will always love, but to be honest, its weather sent me west. So, but I love Chicago.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite cities in the world. So
yes, you and many others it sent west. So,
yeah, and
you know,
I wanted to set the book in Chicago because, one, it was a city I knew well, and it's also a city that does have a certain brand as a city.
Right.
Rife with racial conflict, which is a big part of the story. So it was a city that I thought was a proper setting for this narrative.
Yeah, so let's get into the story. Let's get right into your latest exciting book. What is the backstory, my first question, behind the brilliant, attention-grabbing title, The Alchemy of Noise? Where did that come from?
The Alchemy of Noise was one of those things that, you know, you talk about channeling inspiration. I was looking for a new title for the book. I had had an old working title that I didn't want to use, and I was struck by one of the sort of underlying unspoken themes of the book, which was the matter of taking something horrible, taking something painful, and trying to extrapolate from that something productive and positive, surviving. And I liked the idea of the word alchemy, because that had been, that was the name of my male protagonist's sound company. He called his company
right.
Sound Alchemy. And in one of the
right.
paragraphs of the book, he's describing how his brother-in-law inspired him. His brother-in-law is a sound engineer. And he was talking about how his brother-in-law would make magic with good music. But he said what was really exciting was when he would watch him take music or sounds that weren't good, that were sloppy or inept, and through his own transformational skills, he would turn them into something beautiful. And he references that his brother-in-law said, it's the alchemy of noise. It's that
right.
idea of taking something abrasive and dissonant and turning it into something beautiful, which ultimately is the whole kind of making lemonade out of lemons kind of theory, only much more poetically put. So it jumped out at me as a perfect title for the book, because that's kind of the thrust and theme of the entire story. So that's where that came from.
When you see The Alchemy of Noise at a bookstore, the first thing you're going to do is pick it up. That title is such an attention grabber.
It
is a wonderful title. So
thank you. I thought so too.
Oh, you? Yes. On the book's Amazon page, reviewer Laura Nicole Diamond writes, infused with beauty, humor, and pain, The Alchemy of Noise is a modern American love story that asks if love can bridge the distance between two Americas. But after reading a good part of your book, Lorraine, I say it's a lot more than a love story, but it's also a poignant humanistic mirror into the soul of our society. It seems not only you did the research for this book, but also lived through some of it as well. What's your thoughts on this?
That's correct. Yeah, well, you know, we're in a time right now where there's a lot of discussion and debate about who gets to tell stories of race. There's a lot of people that feel that white writers should not include black characters or any characters outside of their own culture into their stories. And I'm sure you're aware that there's a lot of debate about that, and people have weighed in the pros and cons of it. And the reason I felt that this was my story to tell was it emanated from my life earlier on. When I was a young adult, I was in L.A., as I still am, but I had moved to L.A., and I was very immersed in the music scene. And I lived for 6 years with a black man. And it was through that period of my life that I was awakened, really, long before the term white privilege had been coined. I was awakened to the disparities between the life I was living as a white person and the life he was living as a black person, even in a very urban, contemporary, liberal center like Los Angeles. It was a wake-up
right.
call to me, and it shook me to the core, because as liberal as my upbringing had been, and it had been, I was lucky to have parents who were very open-minded and taught us to judge on soul, not skin. I didn't understand the day-to-day corrosive drip, drip, drip of living in black skin, which is something a white person cannot experience. The closest they can get is by having proximity to someone who is living in black skin, and that's what the experience was for me. And it was very challenging, and it ended many, many years ago. My life moved on, and then when I started writing for the Huffington Post, which I started doing in 2011, I was covering a lot of writing op-eds and cultural commentary on what was happening in our culture at the time and is still happening, which is a lot of, you know, police killings and riots and the pushback
right.
against Obama's election. And the whole discussion of white privilege came up and race, and it became a very roiling social media conversation. And it was then that I decided that I wanted to pull into a piece of fiction this experience that I'd had and bring it into contemporary times and base it on the many, many conversations I was having with people of every demographic, age, race, religion, whatever, on these topics of cultural clashes, racial discrimination, disparities in privilege. And so that was when I got inspired to start writing the book. And I pulled forward my own experience. I did a lot of research. I did interviews. I had it read by sensitivity readers. It was very important to me because I knew there was some controversy over a white writer including black characters the way I do in this book, which is it's not cursory. The black a male character is as profound and as present in the story as the white female character. They equally tell the story. And so in order to do that, I had to make sure I got it right, and that became a very powerful driving force to do. And I, based on my responses from readers within the black community, I believe I've achieved that. Hopefully readers that read it, both white and black readers, will feel that. But it was something that I felt I had a depth of experience to draw on, and so that was what compelled me to write this story, which I think is very, unfortunately, still very timely, sadly still very resonant in our current culture where there is great disparity still in our racial climate. So that was what drove me to write this particular book.
True that. The Black Lives Matter and such definitely just proves that this is still a hot topic. But Lorraine, I want to give you kudos for your main protagonist, Chris Hawkins, an African-American male, and how you got into his head, his thoughts. Now, I know you said you lived with a black man for a few years, but what other research did you do to facilitate, you know, writing such a strong character?
Well, Robert, I think any writer who's worth their salt really climbs inside the mind of whatever character they're writing, you know, and I think that the kind of odd thing about this discussion about who gets to write about race and who gets to include characters of color in their books is that really I think it's based on another problem, which is the underrepresentation of diverse voices in our media, the underrepresentation of black writers telling their stories. That's really the problem. It's not about who gets to talk about what characters, because if we really had that as a mandate, no one would write about space aliens. No one would write about prehistoric characters. No one would write about, you know, we would only be writing about the very thing that we are, which is obviously not the way it goes with writing and literature. Men have been writing women, men have been writing children, women have been writing men, women have been writing, you know, writers have been writing about every kind of living thing from time immemorial. So to suddenly now say we can't write about people outside our own racial demographic is really the wrong solution to a real, very real problem. When you say, how did I get inside his head? The same as I would do any character. My last book, which you and I talked about a few years ago, Hysterical Love, the main protagonist was a 33-year-old male. And people would ask me that same question because it was very well received. And a lot of people said, oh my God, I would never have guessed a woman wrote this. And I said, how did you do this? I said, because I'm an observer of human nature. I'm an observer of the world I live in. I have five brothers. I'm married to a man. I raised a man. I have male friends. As any good writer does, you observe and you research and you pay attention and you climb inside. You listen. You get into the life and breath and words and thoughts of any character you write, no matter what they are.
Correct.
And with this particular writer, this character is nothing like the man I lived with. So it wasn't that I depicted that man. This man is completely 100% created out of my imagination, as I did every character in the book, including the one that, you know, someone might say, is that you? And it's like, no, it's not me. It's a created character. And I gave each of them the same depth of involvement and commitment to creating their inner life, their exterior life, their thoughts, their feelings. So it wasn't, I didn't feel this because I had lived for 6 years in a world which included many black characters. I had the gift of being able to listen to and observe and pay attention to concerns and worries and idiosyncrasies and thoughts and family. And I just pulled all that forward, as any good writer would, to inform the characters of this man and his family and his friends. And, you know, I felt very dedicated to getting that right. And I hope I did, you know. And you're a black man yourself, so if you say I did, I feel like I get a little thumbs up from you.
Well, moving deeper into the Chris Hawkins character, his blackness and day-to-day tribulations of his living while black is a major part of the story, as we discussed. Why did you dive headfirst into this volatile situation, this controversial situation? Did you plan it this way from the beginning?
Yeah, because that was what I experienced. That was what I witnessed and tangentially was impacted by. And it was, you know, well, to go back to a little bit about what sparked me to write this story is there was a time a few years ago, it was during the Ferguson riot. I remember it was very specifically during the Ferguson situation when there were a lot of white people within my circle, some of whom I knew, some of whom I only knew through social media, who were having conversations that were supportive of the black community, but were taking this stance of, it's not ours to talk about, we'll stand here in the back, it's not ours to make comment on, it's not ours to discuss. And I was very taken aback by that, because my perspective about racial dynamics in America is it's white people who have perpetuated this dynamic, and so white people have to be very involved in the solutions towards fixing this enormous historical problem. We can't stand back and say, well, we don't get to comment because if we say the wrong thing, we're going to get attacked. If we do the wrong thing, we're going to be minimized. The thing is, it doesn't matter. It's like I felt like I wrote an article right then for the Huffington Post called No, White People Will Never Understand the Black Experience. But my point was, And I got a tremendous, that was a very, very viral article because there were a lot of people in the black community who felt, who were happy that I wrote it, who said, we've not seen someone write this as candidly as you just did, and we appreciate it. And there were people in the white community who went, well, I guess I didn't know it was that bad. And so I realized, I felt like as a white person who had lived amongst these issues through, by virtue of living in this relationship, I felt like I had the unique position of being able to say, look, you guys, look at this. You got to really pay attention to this. This is not something that's just in the news, over there, happening to somebody way out there. It's something that people are dealing with every single bloody day of their life. And so I felt this deep, powerful mandate to take what I knew and fashion it into an engaging story, a page, hopefully a page turner, a love story, but still convey these really important ideas about what a black man in America and, or what, you know, a black woman in America might go through on a day-to-day basis so that readers might be illuminated, as many people in my own life were when I was conveying these things that were happening in real time decades ago. They would go, oh my God, I had no idea, I had no idea, I had no idea. It was like, well, then we need to start making sure you do have an idea. And so I felt this responsibility to tell it through this story. So it was very important that Chris go through these obstacles and have this gauntlet of experience that people experience every day in America in this story, within the narrative, in the realm of this love story. So that was why I felt it was important to convey reality.
Lorraine, on the other side of the coin, there are two young black female characters in the book, Chris's sister Vanessa and Deontay's girlfriend Jordan, who come across very early on as extremely intense and somewhat self-centered, sort of an angry black woman. Did you get any feedback behind these two characters?
No, and I was concerned about that, but I didn't. In fact, the character of Vanessa is loosely based on a woman that I did a very, well, not based on her, but based on the things that she shared with me, a woman who I did a three-part interview for the Huffington Post, and she was very, very candid and very, very unvarnished in her opinions, and I basically gave, I informed Chris's sister Vanessa with the things that she had shared with me. And this woman read the book, and she loved it. She was very, I said, do you recognize that in that character? And she said, absolutely. And yeah, you know, I thought about that. I thought about that because I didn't want anyone to think that. But I
right.
also realized that I, as a writer, I'm not going to be so cautious that I don't create real people. And these are characters that I've seen and witnessed and experienced. And just as Vanessa is a fierce, passionate, outspoken, edgy woman, her mother, who is also a black woman, is incredibly magnanimous and open-hearted and loving and accepting. So I felt like, despite the fact that these two women were hard-edged, I also offered a black female character who is incredibly loving and warm. And I also offered white young women who were caustic and corrosive as well. So I felt like I had the balance there. And, you know, if somebody were to come at me and say, you've depicted angry black women, I'd say, well, I've depicted all sorts of angry people in this book and all sorts of loving people in this book on both sides of the racial divide. So, you know, I would encourage them not to get caught up in those tropes and really see how these characters inform the main protagonist, because part of why, well, Vanessa for me was very important. The character of Jordan, Deontay's girlfriend, was really about reflecting the way Chris was viewed by women in his own community. This was just a character. It was not, you know, I thought about it. I thought about exactly what you're talking about. And I wondered, I thought, oh God, should I make her nicer? Should I make her less bitchy? Should I make her? And that was just who the character was, you know, and it was, you know, I just decided to go with it, and I figured if anybody took umbrage, I would say, well, go look at Sidoni's friend Patsy, and let's talk about the angry white woman too. You know, I mean, I recognize that that's a trope, but I mean, I felt like she's also a very real character, a woman that I've known. So I decided to go with it and take my chances that people would see it in the context of the whole story. How did you feel about it?
Well, the last thing we want to do, Lorraine, as authors, is walk on eggshells.
Yes.
Be afraid of, you know, definitely, you know, saying some people may not really like it or whatever. You know, you have to write fearless. And speaking of writing fearless, this brings me back to one of my pet peeves. Many people fear that there's a lack of courageous writers these days. Lorraine, what responsibility do artists have to speak out about social and cultural issues?
Well, I think, personally, I think we have a tremendous responsibility, but I also recognize that not every writer wants to. You know, I mean, not every artist wants to. Some artists just want to write things that are entertaining. They want to write romance novels or cartoon novels. And I'm not going to disparage, not that you are, I'm not saying you are disparaging anybody, but I'm not going to disparage anybody for writing things that I'm not interested in reading because they don't have any depth or gravitas to them. I read books that I want to be moved by books. And when I was younger, I grew up for a good portion of my childhood without a TV, and my father used to bring home books from the Chicago Library, and I became absolutely immersed in the power of fiction. It was mostly fiction, because I felt like it tells stories that not only enrapture you in the narrative, right, in the made-up story, but they can also convey themes and the morals of the story in ways that I think that we can almost embrace more easily than if we're reading something nonfictional, something that's more didactic. And I loved that as a reader. So when I started writing books, it was really important to me, and not just writing books, when I was writing songs, when I was writing screenplays, I was always looking for that underlying moral of the story. I always felt like, what was the point of writing something if it was just fluff? Not that there's anything wrong with fluff. I know people love fluff. But for me, there was absolutely no purpose in writing fluff. And I wrote an article recently about this because I was telling you the other day about how someone on Twitter said to me once when they had read a political post of mine, they wrote, aren't you worried that people who are going to read your political opinions and not want to buy your books. And I wrote back and I said, no, because my worldview is imbued in my writing, so they're going to know anyway. And as much as it might turn some people off, it might attract other people. And I wrote an article about this, and I quoted the great Nina Simone, because this quote to me is my motto as an artist. And she said, I have it in front of me because I want to get it exactly right. She said, an artist's duty, as far as I'm concerned, is to reflect the times. How can you be an artist and not reflect the times? That, to me, is the definition of an artist. And I feel the same way. I feel like my job is to reflect the times, and that can come in very entertaining media, right? You can write a great song, you can write a great play, you can write a great screenplay, you can write a great book that is very entertaining and page-turning, but it also conveys a reflection of the times. And that is always going to be my mandate, and certainly with this book, that was, as I said, the driving force behind it. So to answer your question, I personally feel artists do have that responsibility, but only by choice, because if you want to paint flowers and write books about, you know, romance, that's okay too. There is an audience for that.
Yes, and the reason why I went there is because so many are asking me personally and saying that we need more artists that reflect the times. And I think that is it. And that's why your book is so great. So, Lorraine, how does the alchemy of noise fit into your author's voice in comparison to your other two novels?
That's a good question. You know, it's interesting because they're all really different in tone and kind of theme, but where they all share, what they all share is they're involved in human life, in relationships, in family. All three are very involved. All three have very central family themes in them, with tangential kind of stories about. You know, my first book, it was about a father who had, a daughter who had found her father's journal after he died and discovered that he had felt she was a failure. And though that was all about family, there were tangential themes related to finding one's path in life and understanding the truth of who one is. My second book was a young guy looking for his father's lost love because he was convinced that she held the keys to all answers about love. And though it was funny and crazy, it also had these underlying themes about really recognizing who the people are in your life that matter and being able to see the truth and honesty of people that sometimes you misunderstand, meaning your parents or your siblings or even your friends. So and then in this book, of course, family plays a huge role in both the lives of the two main protagonists. We climb inside both their families. And so I think that they all connect in that way that human life connects to itself, to each other. Those tend to be the themes that I'm drawn to. The palette is smaller, the canvas is smaller than someone who's writing about wars and writing about, you know, bigger issues. My canvas tends to be more immediate, although with The Alchemy of Noise, of course, the canvas opens up into kind of the larger social problems having to do with police profiling and a justice system that is not always fair and unbiased. So it does step outside of the family realm more so than the other two books do. So I guess that I'm throwing my net a little wider with this one, but it's still very much involved in human relationships and family.
Well, throwing your net out a little wider is always a good thing in my estimation. Lorraine, so many readers, especially millennials, are reading stories and articles on their cell phones. With flash fiction and microstories becoming more and more popular, it seems like the attention span of the reading public is getting shorter by the minute. Do you think this radically changes the future of how we write and publish our books?
I think it changes the industry, and I don't know, you know, I think there's still enough of us people that enjoy reading longer form around that there's still a market for that, but I do wonder what happens as, you know, we die off and younger generations move into the, you know, the majority. You know, I guess I think it's interesting because one of the campaigns for my new book was on Instagram, and most of the bloggers writing about it were much younger women than myself. And I was encouraged to see that there is this tremendous community of younger readers who love books, who are obsessed by books almost. And that was encouraging because I think you're absolutely right about the shorter attention span and the reading on cell phones and whatever. But I think that there is still a tremendously large contingent of readers in every age group who still love to sit down with a good book. I think that there is, in the sort of viral internet world, this kind of meme that plays out that, you know, defines what's a contemporary person as, you know, running around with their phone and sending Instagrams. And I think all that's true. But I think at the end of the day, those same people who are contemporary and very much a part of the current world, at the same time, I think at the end of the day, they go back and curl into bed with a book. I know young people who do that, male and female. So I guess I have hope. You know, I have hope that a good story is always going to have value. You know, I think that, you know, there are stages in a person's life. You know, I think a lot of young people are not as interested in books maybe in their 20s, but then as they get older, they start to enjoy reading more. I've seen that has happened as well. I know people in my age group who tell me that they didn't get into books until they were in their 30s and 40s. So I think that there's always hope that if writers write great stories, I think it's really about writers writing great stories and publishers having the courage to publish great stories. I think that the publishing industry is not very courageous right now. I'm going to say that. I don't.
There's that word courage again.
Yeah. I don't think it is. I think they go for the low-hanging fruit when it comes to what they think is going to go viral and what they think is going to be popular. And sometimes they turn down work that is really important and cutting edge and fresh and new for something that seems more buzzy. And that's why, you know, like my publisher, it just won a big award, and it was the first time a hybrid publisher had ever won this independent publisher's award. But they're very courageous in choosing works that are, you know, draw outside the lines. She Writes Press and their president, Brooke Warner, and CEO, Crystal Patriarch, who are very bold in what they choose to publish because they don't want to be confined to what's considered trendy or, you know, what's already happening. They want to look forward to things that are more cutting edge. So I feel grateful because they published my book, you know, when I had been told by every agent that I would not find a publisher because I was a white writer writing black characters. So
right.
I like their courage.
And, you know, I'd say the same thing about courage for films and other aspects. I mean, I'm looking at the news today and there's an advertisement for the latest Spider-Man movie. And, like, I'm thinking to myself, yeah, Isn't this the 100th Spider-Man movie that just came out? And, you know, I think it's in all forms of media. But
I do, too.
Yeah. Let's switch gears. And
okay.
I'd like to ask you, in a time where hundreds of thousands of books are published every year in so many different types of platforms, so many authors want to know how they can make their book stand out from all the rest. It's not an easy task. How do you handle this, Lorraine? How do you handle the marketing aspect of being an author?
Well, I think it's ongoing. You know, I think that it is a conundrum, you know, because here I am, you know, 2 months into my book being published, you know, and I had a wonderful publicity company I was working with, BookSparks, who I contracted to do the launch period of my book. But, you know, it, depending on your budget, my budget was limited to that launch period. And now I will kind of be moving into the marketing pretty much on my own with some assist from them and some assist from my publisher. But by and large, I'll be back to doing it on my own. And I think it's very challenging. To be honest with you, I wish I had a magic word I could say. I think it is the most difficult part about being a writer, because right now in every arena of the arts, maybe every arena of everything, because of the internet and because of the easy access for anybody to get anything out into the, you know, out into the world via the internet, we are just bombarded, inundated, tsunamied with product of every kind and at every level of quality, and it's sometimes very difficult to suss out which things merit our attention. And as a writer, I guess my advice would be make sure you've written. I mean, I think this was a thing that I wrote a lot of articles about it back in the day. It was when self-publishing first really came into the fore. There was this attitude that a writer could just write something and throw it out there and get it up on Amazon, and it didn't matter what it looked like. It didn't matter. I heard even one writer say, well, I can't afford an editor, so I'm just putting it up there as is. And I think the incredible pushback to that was that a lot of really crappy, sloppy books made it into the marketplace and oversaturated the book market with work that was really subpar. And so the self-publishing industry immediately was slapped with the stigma of crap. It's all junk.
Right.
It's all just
right.
People putting things up for their, you know, their aunt or their mother. But the fact was, in the midst of all of that were some excellent writers, tremendous writers, writers as good as any writer being published by the Big Five, who wrote brilliant books but had a really difficult time getting pulled out of this pack of dreck. And so some of them I know have given up, which is really sad, because I'm thinking of this one particular writer who is one of my absolute favorite writers. He's British. He's brilliant. He's written some brilliant books. His name is Mark Berry. If anybody wants to look him up, look him up. He's brilliant. And trying to break out of that self-published market is brutal. So, I mean, the only thing you can do, and we talked about this the other day, is do the absolute best work you can. Get it, pay for it. It's a cost of doing business. Pay for getting it professionally edited to within the inch of its life. Pay to get it professionally formatted, professionally designed. Pay to get a professional cover. Covers are huge. If you have a very amateurish cover, you will lose in this market because, you know, most people just put their books up on Amazon, and that little thumbnail is the first thing somebody is going to see about your book. And if it looks like, you know, your cousin, 12-year-old cousin Bobby drew it with colored pencils, which some covers do, you're going to get passed on by the selective reader. Covers mean everything to me. If I see a really amateurish cover, I don't care what the book's about. I won't even look at it because that tells me the author doesn't understand the market they're in. So make sure you get a professional cover, do all of that, and then try to get other authors that you admire to read your book and write some endorsements. Get it on social media and really be careful and selective about how you promote it on social media because, as we discussed the other day, this inundation of, you know, I've seen this happen where you open your Twitter feed and there's like 12 tweets in a row about the same book. You know, read this book, this book. And right then you just discount that book immediately because you're like, oh, no, they don't know what they're doing. You have to mix up your promotion of your work with interest in other artists and interesting anecdotes about your views on the movie you saw last night or a cake you baked. Then here's a thing about my book. And then, oh, here's a thing about another writer I love. You've got to mix it up and not have it all be about you and your book, or people just become inured and shut off to anything to do with your book. Showing interest and sharing the work of other artists is a huge, huge thing to do because it's not only gracious and generous, but it engenders goodwill. And it also makes those people want to share about you. And you don't do it for that reason. You do it because this is a writer I love, or this is a book I love, or this is somebody that I think you should know about. You do it sincerely and authentically, but it does engender goodwill, and those are the kinds of things you should focus on. I know there's a formula, I don't remember what it is, but there's some kind of percentage of how much you should post about yourself or your book and how much you should post about other people. But it's important to get that percentage right and not overdo the trumpet blowing for yourself, because it will become annoying to people. You don't want to annoy people. But it's hard finding that balance. I mean, when your question was, how do you do it? It's hard. You know, every writer I know thinks it's hard. Sometimes you take a step back.
Things.
You go back to your writing. Keep writing something new or something different. And then you come back in and you do a promotional campaign, or you get your book on you sell it, you do a bargain book thing for a period of time. You know, you find new ways to keep coming back at it.
And there's no one magic formula. So in closing, Lorraine, how do people get in contact with you? Can you give out your website address and any other contact information?
Sure, it's just my name. Yeah, LorraineDevonWilkie.com. And you can get any information you need from that site. You can sign up to be on my mailing list and get my newsletter, which I send out only about 4 times a year. I don't kill people with that. to get on all my social media. The website is the best place to go because it has everything under one roof. So that's LorraineDevonWilkie.com.
Fantastic. So this has been the Author's Lab with me, Robert Batista. My story is The City Game, My Baby Has No Name, can be read for free online at Booksy.com. My guest has been the fearless author and so much more, Lorraine Devon Wilkie. Thank you so much, Lorraine, for being my guest on The Author's Lab. Have a great rest of the day.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Robert. Take care. We'll talk again soon.
It's been a pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.